This is Strategy Taken, a podcast about hard decisions and how strategic leaders in financial services make them, with your host, Luis Sorzella.
Today, we have here my friend, Jake Tamarkin. Jake is the CEO and co-founder of Everyday Life. Everyday Life is a seed stage startup in the life insurance space that is working to make life insurance accessible for all. Like Everyday Life works both on a direct-to-consumer model as a distribution platform through its website, everydaylifeinsurance.com, or on a B2B service for life and health insurance, providing direct-to-consumer as a service. Did I describe this correctly?
Yeah, yes, you did.
I understand that we're going to have a very interesting story about the creation of Everyday Life, making it what it is today. But before we go there, why don't we start? Can you tell us a little bit about Everyday Life?
Yeah, if you don't mind, I'd like to start with how we created the company and why. So me and my co-founder, Dipali, started Everyday Life together 3 years ago. And it was really after both of us, each of us individually, had frustrating experiences as consumers buying life insurance that we recognized there was a big opportunity here. For my co-founder, Dipali, she has a deep technology background, but not in insurance. And so for her, that frustrating experience was sort of the typical consumer experience. For me, it was a little different and extra humiliating, actually, because I had 20 years of insurance experience when I went to go buy it as a consumer, first time as a consumer, was kind of surprised by the difficulty I had in buying what I thought was kind of a smart coverage plan for myself. And what ended up happening was, in that frustration, I thought, gosh, if I'm having such a hard time, you know, and I've been in the business for a long time, I wonder how regular everyday people fare. And when I started looking into it, I was really surprised and horrified by the state of the industry. Basically, in the United States, at least, it's kind of bifurcated where the people who are wealthier are pretty much using the product as they always have. But for middle income and lower income families, they are not using life insurance nearly as much as they used to. LIMRO, which is a major industry trade group, came out with a study, for example, last year that showed in the last 10 years, use of life insurance among families making less than $100,000, which, by the way, is 2/3 of the households in the
U.S. population, yes.
Yeah, that their ownership of life insurance fell by 24% over the last 10 years. And that was mainly due to employers getting out of the benefits business and actually getting out of the employment business as a lot of people shifted into the gig economy. And no one's really stepped in to replace that. And that's the opportunity that we saw. So Dipali and I started this company together. And the idea was initially to sell life insurance to middle-income families in the U.S. and to differentiate, instead of a pure transactional experience for people, we lead with an advisory type of experience that ends up making the coverage more affordable for people by tailoring it to their more individual needs. So they're never paying for coverage they don't need. So that was the basic idea that we took to market.
By the way, I completely understand where you're coming from because I too like work with insurance companies and my own experience buying insurance is also a mix of some things which were overcomplicated for me and of a lot of things that I had to go through which were too simple for me.
Yeah. You know, if you look at the life insurance industry in the U.S., I mean, I think a lot of this applies to other markets as well, but I'm most familiar with the U.S. There's over 700 life insurance companies. Collectively, they bring in about $1 trillion a year in annual income. And that it really could be, though, $2 trillion a year if they were more effectively serving the entire market. So there's a massive financial opportunity. But also, for me, there's a social impact opportunity to use technology to level the playing field. You know, it disturbs me to see this product, and not just life insurance, but annuities and health insurance, is becoming a luxury good more and more, which is kind of the opposite of what's happening in other financial domains. If you think about like mutual funds and how investment minimums have collapsed, investment costs have collapsed, it's easier than ever for anyone to get a mutual fund or a bank account for that matter. But in the life insurance world, things have moved the other direction, where it's like harder than it has been in a long time for regular everyday people to get life insurance.
Can we be a little specific? Like, for example, I know a lot of complaints, a lot of difficulties. Right. And by the way, I know that the number one problem that people have with life insurance is that they say that they are intimidated by the whole process and the product. And there's also a lot of lack of trust. But like, can you talk about what is the specific problems that you set up to solve?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. And this is kind of, and when we start talking about the strategic challenges and decisions we've had to make along the way, I think we've learned more about the problems that we're solving, and in some ways have kind of shifted a little bit as we gained a greater appreciation for the problems we're solving. The broader problem was getting life insurance to everyone who needs it. But from a consumer perspective, you talk to them, the people will talk about the cost, like you said, the complexity as well, and not knowing who to trust. So, you know, we initially really focused on the cost, thinking that if we can lower the cost for people by helping them be smarter shoppers, then we can, then they'll trust us, and that will eliminate the complexity problem. Over time, though, we grew to appreciate there are other barriers that are making it difficult for people. When I say it's harder than it has been in the past for people to get life insurance, what I'm specifically referring to is the evolution in underwriting. You know, traditionally it was, if you were to buy a policy, you'd probably have to get a medical exam, and that's a huge pain. So the industry's been working really hard to streamline that process and make it less inconvenient for people. But in so doing, they have actually created new barriers, because maybe you don't need a medical exam, but instead we're going to look more closely at your credit report, and sort of inadvertently introducing bias into the underwriting process by accidentally favoring more affluent people. I'm not sure if it's entirely accidental, but it's still the effect. So we realized, and we'll get more into this in this conversation, but we realized that it wasn't just about advising people on how much to buy and configuring the policy in the optimal way. It was also the problem we also needed to solve was finding a product that people are actually going to get approved for, and that also makes financial sense for them. So that was kind of a new challenge that we really only appreciated once we got into market.
So I understand that this is at the core of the story that you're going to tell us today, right? So how did that happen?
Yeah. So I mentioned we started the company about 3 years ago. We're building this platform. We had an insurance company partner. We raised about $1 million, kind of enough to get to market and kind of prove out our minimum viable product. And our goal was to demonstrate that consumers valued our unique value proposition and build a business case for further investment. We built this direct-to-consumer online distribution platform with one insurance company, integrated with one insurance company, brought their product to market. It was probably a 6 month or so process to integrate that first product, that first insurance product onto our platform. And we were really positioned not as an independent agent so much as a solution provider. We had one product. People would come to us almost like they might go to an insurance company, you know, expecting to get this one product. Mm-hmm. For us, it was a big investment, a big push to get this product to market. This was first quarter of 2020. So a few weeks in to after we launched it, the pandemic hits and, you know, had a lot of impacts, of course, across our society. But in the life insurance world, it was like a light switch went off and, you know, just kind of instantly reminded an entire generation of people that, hey, there's this product out there that you might want to check out during these uncertain times.
So, like, the life insurers also took started paying much more attention to DTC and electronic channels, right?
Yes, exactly. True. Traditional brokers, you know, couldn't do business in the office anymore. They had to learn what Zoom is and how to do electronic signatures. And it definitely accelerated some investments that insurance companies were trying to make to modernize their businesses. and brought additional interest into, like you said, D2C in general, you know, direct to consumer marketing in general. But from where we are sitting as this early stage startup, we just saw this massive influx of traffic in March of 2020. And, you know, notwithstanding all of the concerns we all have about the pandemic generally, it was actually very helpful for our business because, you know, for a new brand, getting traffic to your site is one of the hardest and most expensive things there is to do. So that was great. But what we started discovering pretty quickly was that our customers were getting rejected by our underwriting partner. You know, so we were, just to be clear for your listeners, we were acting as a distributor where we would connect someone to a product that was integrated on our website, but ultimately the underwriting decisions were being made by the insurance company that where we were an appointed agent. That their underwriting criteria, we learned, was such that 90% of our applicants were getting rejected. Our underwriting partner never said like, oh, this product is designed for rich people. I don't even think they even think of it that way. But just after years and years and years and decades and decades and decades of focusing on the broker channel, brokers tending to serve more affluent people, and underwriting, learning their underwriting through serving that market, they ended up with a product that was very hard for people of more modest means to get approved for. So we were kind of faced with this crossroads of, we're finding our target market pretty well in our marketing, but they're not getting approved by our underwriter. The people that are getting approved are more affluent people who were kind of fell outside of our target market. So I mentioned we had raised about $1 million, which goes surprisingly quickly. And, you know, we're at this kind of crossroads of, we've got this product in market and we're selling it to some people, but it's not the people we set out to serve. And the people that we set out to serve are not qualifying for our product.
So, Jake, today you frame the mission of your company as bringing life insurance for everybody. How clear that mission was at that point?
You know, it was the same mission. We were lacking awareness of the consumer problems we needed to solve to truly make life insurance accessible to everyone. Mm-hmm. We thought it was primarily a cost issue. And what we learned was that there was this bias in the underwriting that actually is at least as problematic as the cost issue. And we also learned that as underwriting gets more modernized and algorithmic and rules driven, that it was kind of institutionalizing or making systemic some of these biases. So we, as an industry, were at risk of turning an exclusive club into an even more exclusive club. So that is a big problem, but also, you know, problem to our mission, but also an opportunity to serve.
Yes. So you had a product, your marketing was generating demand. What you were providing was not adequate for that demand. So the question was, do I change the product? Do I change the people that I market to?
Exactly. And, you know, we were selling policies. It was clear that if we moved up market, we could sell more policies. We could radically improve our conversion rate and probably build a good, you know, business around that. On the flip side, there were a lot of reasons why we were trying to serve this, you know, relatively lower income market. Part of it being that it's a less competitive space. You know, the top end of the market is very, very, very competitive. That's where all the agents are all day long. And also, you know, that was our primary motivation. You know, both of us as founders were very successful, you know, professionals before we started the company. We had other ways we could, you know, make money. We wanted to make this company because we saw a big opportunity to help people that weren't being helped well. So those are some of the trade-offs we're thinking about. On the other hand, we've got very limited capital and we basically have enough to get to the next milestone. And, you know, and time is money and money is time. So it would be a lot easier to change our marketing. You know, this is all digital marketing. We can change the demographic profile of who we're targeting in a matter of hours. Changing the product, I mentioned before, it took us 6 months to integrate that first insurance product. So adding in more is going to seriously slow us down. at a time when we don't have a lot of time or money. To me, as a startup entrepreneur at this point, time and money are essentially the same thing. I feel like that's like Einstein's second theory of relativity. If you were an entrepreneur, that would be what it is. Time is money. It really, truly is. So anyway, so, you know, both paths were fraught with risk. You know, we could go down the path of moving up market. We could definitely sell some policies, but it also complicates our investor story. Like, what is our mission? And how do we address the fact that that's a very competitive market? Or the plan B, the other option is add more products that are more suitable to our audience and do improve our conversion rate with our current marketing. Some of the trade-offs there being, well, that's going to basically knock us out of market for 6 months at a time when we don't really have time to do that or the resources to sit on the sidelines for half a year.
So how was the process with deciding of what we were going to do?
Well, there was a lot of internal debate and soul searching among me and my co-founder and our advisors. We had the benefit of having gone through an accelerator program, and we had a fair number of stakeholders, not just investors, but also people who are just genuinely interested in helping us. And we got advice from a lot of people, you know, which just to flesh out each option better, like, what does it really mean to switch our marketing, to move up market? What's that really going to cost? How's that going to benefit us? Getting to a deeper level of understanding of what these options are. And then, you know, on the flip side, if we do add more products, what products would they be? How long would it really take us to add them? And, you know, would it be enough? Would it be good enough? You know, our advisors pointed out other examples in the market of both paths. Both paths are viable in the sense that there are companies doing similar things in both strategies. So it's telling us that it's not that the world has decided there's one path. You know, you could conceivably go down either. It's not that only one is viable and therefore your decision is really easy. What eventually emerged though, as we were talking to all of our stakeholders, whenever times got rough for our company, and I guess this was the first time they got rough, but well, you know, you always get challenges. Life is a roller coaster. What came through though was the reason why people invested in us more than because we're an amazing team or because we built some cool technology, more than anything is that they were excited about the mission and the problem that we were solving and the people that we were, the societal problem we were solving. And that was really what motivated our investors and our stakeholders, our advisors too, the people who are volunteering their time and expertise and network to help us. That's the reason why they're helping us more than anything else. And, you know, through all those conversations, as that emerged, we realized, wow, our mission is actually an incredibly valuable asset. And by the way, we were doing some initial hiring at this point too. And that was just another data point. You know, recruiting super talented people who have lots of options is hard to do. Having that mission was as a part of our employee value proposition was a difference maker for us in a competitive labor market. So we realized, gosh, this mission is very, very valuable. And as painful as it's going to be to basically shut down our business for 6 months while we onboard more product, it was clear that that would be less painful than coming up with some new mission retrofitted into our circumstance and coming up with some competitively differentiating and compelling value proposition that would get this more affluent market excited for us and get the investment community and stakeholders excited about us. That was actually in the near term, there was like some benefit. Yeah, we can generate some quick sales, but in the long term, it was going to be a much harder story to tell, much harder to recruit people and investors. So, you know, that we got real clarity out of hearing from our community of investors and other stakeholders about the value of our mission as an asset. And once we really understood that, the choice became a little bit clearer. In other words, our investors would forgive us if we essentially shut down for 6 months while we brought on more product. That was an easier story to sell than, hey, we're completely pivoting into a new market that is super competitive, but we're going to generate some sales right now. It'll be cool. Maybe we'll pivot back to the other market at some point. That's just a very complicated and not credible story.
By the way, Jake, kudos to you, because it's somewhat easy to have the long-term view and a dispassionate view about risk when you are providing recommendations or when you're in a big company. I have a full appreciation for how hard it is to do in a startup in a situation that you were. So kudos.
Thanks. Well, I appreciate that. You know, once we had that clarity, though, it became easy. I think one of the hardest things for a startup is to, I think it's true in general, but just for when you're in a startup where every decision feels existential, you know, maintaining clarity and focus on what's important is a huge challenge. And partly because there's a lot of opportunities, a lot of potential directions you could go in, but focus, the hard part about focus is ignoring a lot of other things. Like being focused on something means ignoring a lot of other things, pursuing one thing at the expense of everything else. And through that episode and ever since then, what I've grown to appreciate is have strategic commitment and focus are extremely valuable to the early stage entrepreneur. It's just hard to do, but it's very valuable. You know, you've got limited resources. You got to point all your guns at one target. If you spread your resources too thinly, then you're guaranteed to fail. But if you aim everything at one target, it turns out what I've learned is even if that was the wrong target, you will figure that out faster and be able to adjust and respond. You're more likely to succeed than if you try and spread your bets.
Jake, let me ask you to speculate a little bit. If you were back at that position with what you know today, what would you have done the same way? What you would have done differently?
Well, I have no regrets about the decision that we made. In fact, time has just proven to us that that was a good call because, you know, we were able to get more product on our shelf. We started selling more policies. We were able to, our investors were patient with us as we hit our milestones, kind of our new milestones. And then we were able to raise more money at a more attractive valuation for us. And every step along the way, that mission and the commitment to the mission proved to be a difference maker. When we were talking to the additional insurance companies who wanted to bring on board, they're like, oh, we love your mission. That's great. We want to serve those same people too. When we were talking to the next round of investors, that's what was exciting to them. And then as we grew and we're hiring more people, the labor market was even more competitive than ever. And it's the mission was the difference maker. So that has really validated everything. So no regrets on the decision. I think on the execution, you know, I'm always learning about how to move faster. And one of the things I've learned, I think about an analogy of the tools you would use to build a sculpture. You know, you have like a big chisel and you have little chisels. You know, the big chisel knocks off a lot of stone. The little chisels maybe get you to the finer detail. And that was a big chisel time. And maybe I was approaching it with a small chisel. You know, and in other words, we were worried about really vetting every single product, really making sure the user experience before we got to market was picture perfect. So what ended, it probably took longer in the long run because not every product we brought on board worked out. We could have learned that a lot faster if instead of going one at a time and making each one perfect, if we just brought a whole bunch on, yeah, we would have been drowning in craziness, but we would have learned a lot faster which were the right products. And, you know, I think the whole name of the game with any kind of new initiative is like, can you learn what it's going to take to win faster than you burn through your resources?
Yes.
You know, learn before you burn, right? That's the race.
I like both the analogy and the general rule. So, Jake, thank you very much. That was a very interesting story. Again, congratulations on what you've built and where you are. Again, to our listeners, if you would like to check, Jake's website is everydaylifeinsurance.com. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Luis. This is a great conversation. Appreciate the opportunity to share our story. I love your podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to our podcast and find us on thestrategytaken.com. Thank you for listening. If you are open to knowing more, you can subscribe to our podcast and find us on thestrategytaken.com.